Picture that approaches sculpture nearest is the best picture. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank you all for joining me this week. I appreciate all the support, and I hope you will continue to listen and share and like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Newcomers, the same goes to you, and please feel free to go back and listen through the previous episodes. I appreciate that. I actually had a couple of people this past week reach out and let me know that they're doing that. One of them was actually on YouTube, came by a live stream. I think his name was Matt Gardner. He tried to give me some information via the YouTube chat. However, YouTube's chat does not allow you to post links. So, Matt, I didn't hear from you after that initial message. But feel free, please, to email me or message me on X if you did have something you want to pass along. I am looking forward to hearing from you. So, that out of the way, let's go ahead and dive into this week's episode. I'm thinking that the Levant's going to take a little bit more time than I thought. I just, having, you know, a lot of stuff come up, and I feel like, you know, I might have to do some shorter episodes this for the next couple of weeks. And also, there's more stuff I want to get into, and I really want to dive in. So this is probably going to take a little bit, probably another 2-3 weeks at the minimum. So, after our quick check-in with Jericho, or Ines Sultan, or Tel Es Sultan, and seeing what's happening to a candidate for the first city, we talked about some of the general changes that happened last season, and then, of course, this season as well. This week, we're going to be moving and going over to more specific changes in material cultures that have been living in the Southern Levant and are going to continue to occupy the Levant for this season. And some of which will even stretch into next season, much like the Yarmukian culture did last season. And to start with, I am going to go back and talk about the Yarmukian culture, or Yarmukian, I'm not sure which is more appropriate. I've heard it pronounced the two different ways. In English, I've heard Yarmukian, and some people speaking with a British accent or foreign accent say Yarmukian, so I'm not sure which is more appropriate. But I mentioned them last season, and they emerge right around 6400 BC. And they are the first material culture in the Levant to enter the pottery Neolithic stage. They're the PPNA, the pre-pottery, or they're kind of, they're presaging the end of the pre-pottery Neolithic in the Levant. And it's their style pottery that dominates the Levant, starting about 100 years or so after that initial site appears. And then after 400 years, as the dominant material culture in the region, this culture appears or disappears around the start of the season. Or it's rather, I guess it's the standard pottery type you see sees a massive drop in use. Instead, you see several smaller regional cultures begin to emerge in old Yarmukian sites or areas on the fringe of the old Yarmukian territory begin to become more distinct. Now, that's the traditional view. However, some people argue that instead, there's just a change in pottery production and style, arguing that there are a lot of other types of tools, burial traditions, personal ornamentation, etc., that remains consistent with the Yarmukian period. So instead of the Yarmukian culture being pushed back from some areas, it may be that these different parts of the Yarmukian society or, you know, range just begin to experiment and change just naturally. This could just be a part of the growth, and they're not being pushed out. One of the big things that kind of helps show this is that a lot of sites don't show any evidence of, you know, destruction or desolation or abandonment. They're continuously occupied for at least a couple of hundred years after the end of this season. So that's one of those things that we're going to dive into. Again, the Yarmoukian culture, it's either disappearing at the start of the season or it's evolving in these various sub-regions of the Levant. But I did want to go over the name because I don't believe I did that last season. And I do want to cover the etymology of this. So the name comes from the Yarmouk River. This is the largest tributary of the Jordan River. And it runs in modern-day Jordan, Syria, Israel. And I think it also touches some of the West Bank. And it kind of drains, it carries a lot of the drainage from the Hauran Plateau. So it is very vital for a lot of life in this specific area. And it always kind of has been, at least for the settled human society. Now, the name of the river itself, I could not get a firm consensus. It seems like it's debated. It may be something, and this is more of the modern kind of translation, and it may have been drawn from the river itself, like the definition of this may have been drawn from the river instead of giving the river its name. But in Arabic, it's like Nahar al-Yarmouk, or Nahar He Yarmouk. I think that's the Hebrew pronunciation, but essentially it would mean something like sacred chasm. Now the Greek version of the river was Hieromikas or Mikes, and that's a little weirder because it also means sacred, but it's sacred, as far as I could tell, was mushroom or sacred fungus, something along those lines. I don't know if there's another Mikes or if they were just, the Greeks maybe were Greekizing the Mouk part. Maybe they heard Mouk from the Hebrew. Or maybe one of the other Semitic languages spoken in the area. Kind of unsure on that. However, another interesting theory I read was that it may be a very old kind of Afro-Asiatic, their term for river or, you know, would be like Ya or Hye would just be the river. So in Hebrew, we know that there is the Yarmouk, the Yarden, and the Yarkhan. So this could be the River Din, the River Mouk, the River Khan. We don't know. But that is a theory I read. And those would be like maybe a name for a people. And remember, the Nile in Hebrew was Yeor. So it isn't, you know, too out of the realm of possibility that, yes, it could have been the river Mouk, and Mouk could have been something that we're just not sure what it meant back in the day, but it has come to mean sacred chasm, both in Hebrew and Arabic, I believe. But that's, at least that's one of the more coherent theories I found. I found some other crazy ones too, but those I can't really wrap my head around, so I'm just not going to include those. I would recommend looking it up, but just a little interesting side note I wanted to get into. So, now, the Yarmoukian culture was pretty much occupied a lot of the central Levant, all the way down to kind of the southern border of the Sinai, almost. Now, there are some other cultures that are emerging or are breakaway parts of the Yarmukian. We're not sure which. It's possible that they were just peoples who were already living in the area, and they were influenced by the Yarmukian, and they developed their own style and kind of twist on tools, pottery, things like that. And these two cultures that kind of tie into today's episode are the Lodian and the Nizanim cultures. Though, as we will see, it's possible that, again, there may not be two cultures. There might just be the one, or maybe the Yarmukian and the other. But we'll talk about that for a moment. But I want to start with the Lodian culture. Now, this is named after the type site of Lod, or Lida is another way it's pronounced. And this occupied what is now southern Israel, and it covered the area south of what is now modern Tel Aviv. And if you look at a map, Lod or Lida is readily identifiable. There are still people living there today. But it basically goes from Lod in the northwest, and then it moves to the east to the other side of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River. And it occupied, or they found artifacts from this culture as far east as Ein Gazal and Kirbet ed Dari, or Darich. I'm not sure the correct pronunciation on that, so apologies to anyone that speaks either Arabic or Hebrew. Now, the etymology of Lod is also one of those that we're not really sure about. In Arabic, I think, is the closest language that it can have to be translated, which is something like to quarrel. However, the problem with that is the city was named and is mentioned in not just the Bible, but in other sources as being Lod before Arabic would have emerged as a language. I think it shows up in some Egyptian writings, like in the very early dynastic period. Now, Proto-Arabic may have existed, so it's possible that it could be related to, this could be a case of like two different families of this, or two different languages in the same family coming up with a very similar sounding word, and they may have like a very similar you know, sound, but they may mean different things. It's hard to say. I think specifically, and you might want to look this up. I can't explain it. I'm not a linguist. It's too much for me to wrap my head around. But they say it's a tri-consonantal root, and it's not extant in Northwest Semitic, but only in Arabic. And it can mean to quarrel. It can mean to hinder. It can mean to withhold. Make of that what you will. I think the name Lod is much older than Arabic, which I don't think we even see in any mention, like in terms of the language. It's not written down in any form until like the Achaemenid Persian Empire, where their sources are writing down Arabic words. Now, very possible that, you know, Arabic was spoken earlier than that, but that's the earliest it's written down, you know, so like the 500-600s BC. We have the name Lod at least double that, if not three times that being the name of the location. So make of that what you will. You'll see it in Greek as Lida. That's how it shows up in the New Testament. So that's the type site for the Lodian culture. That's where it was found. That's where they found the most artifacts. These peoples, or at least people mirroring the Lodian culture and their tools and things like that, they are one of the peoples that are reusing Jericho at this very late period. And Lod emerges at the very start of this season. It starts from 6,000 and it goes all the way into next season, about 3,500 BC. So it's a very long-lasting culture, fairly widespread, and it grows, retracts, and grows. It's one of those places where we talked about where they're having a lot of smaller communities. And then some, you know, decent-sized towns, probably about 4,500 BC, give or take. And then, again, you'll see seasonal, like, seasonal habitation in other places, too. Now, this takes me to the, I'm going to butcher this again, Nizanim culture, or Nizanim. I'm not sure the correct way to pronounce it. Now, this is occupies a very narrow gap. It is kind of the coastal plain just to the west of Lod and to the south of Tel Aviv, which is about as far south as the Yarmukian culture gets, at least for this season, if it, you know, when it breaks up. And it is a very narrow strip. I think it goes from that place I mentioned, kind of that little strip of land, all the way south to, I think it's the modern town of Zikim in southern Israel, which is about 2 miles or so from the Gaza Strip border. So very, very short, small section. Or I should say territory, not section. Now, the Nizanim culture is one of the more controversial ones that I mentioned. There is debate about whether or not this is an extension maybe of the Lodian, if this might have been a site where some peoples that are actually part of the Lodian culture may have come seasonally to fish or, you know, travel through the coastal plain there. And it's kind of hard to say because there are only 3 sites associated with the Nizanim culture. Zikim, which I mentioned earlier, Nizanim itself, which is, again, the type site, which is where it gets its name, and the other is Givat HaParsa. Now, for whatever reason, I think there was some issue with the stratigraphy of these sites, so it was kind of hard to date them properly, and there's only been one radiocarbon date from any of these sites that has been useful, essentially. The one that actually gave, or one piece of archaeological evidence that they've been able to successfully radiocarbon date. And that dates to about 5,600 to about 5,500 BC. Now, this is an issue because that dates it to what's known as the Wadi Raba culture, which postdates both the Yarmukian and the Lodian at a lot of their sites. I know I mentioned the Lodian, it lasted until about 3,500. I'm getting some kind of different signals from what I can kind of reconcile with the different dates I'm getting is that perhaps the Lodian kind of contracted towards the kind of the end part of this season, and it just occupied a couple of sites, and they're kind of forced out. Or again, you might have this type of this new kind of art style, or you know, something like that that kind of begins to take over. Maybe the Wadi Raba culture taking over the Yarmukian, or evolving from the Yarmukian, is now beginning to push into the Lodian. This is one of those things that I'm not really the best at kind of deciphering, but that's kind of my reading on this. Now, to get back to the Nizanim, they had very simple pottery, much like the Lodian, a lot like the Yarmukian, very simplistic designs and in terms of how it's created. They also had, arrowheads, sickle blades that they would use probably to harvest wild or semi-wild or domesticated crops. And they didn't really use hand axes. There have not been a whole lot of hand axes found at this area, which isn't surprising. I don't think there's a whole lot of trees in this section of the world at this time. So they probably wouldn't really need to chop things up too much. The sickle blades are enough probably to cut grass or sedges or things like that. But they have also found hole punches, which kind of leads me to believe that they are making most of their clothing out of leathers or hides or things like that. So probably nothing flax or textile-based in this region just yet. Now, that leads me to move on to the Wadi Rabah culture. Now, this culture is beginning to emerge right in the middle part of the 5th millennium. So 5,400, 5,500, give or take a couple hundred years one way or the other. And these are located at some of the old Yarmukian sites. However, this is one of those things where, again, we've had this debate that's brought up that, well, is it really that different than the Yarmukian? They are building structures very similar to the Yarmukian. They are making these large kind of courtyard structures. And they are occupying some of the same places that the Yarmukian are. I think the biggest one that they found was at Ain el Jarba, and of course Wadi Rabah as well. I know that this is one of those places where there is a very high amount of evidence for obsidian trade, with obsidian coming down from, I think, eastern Anatolia, upper Mesopotamia. And there is evidence of contact with those places at Ain el Jarba. That's where you find the most southernmost spread of the artifacts coming from Anatolia and kind of upper Mesopotamia is at Ain el Jarba, which is in, I believe, modern-day Israel, and it's just to the north of the West Bank as well. And this is kind of in the the Jezreel Valley. So, one of the big places you travel through. This would be a natural terminus if you were coming down from Anatolia. You probably wouldn't want to go much further south, probably. You've already come a long way, and the terrain's not very inviting at that point. Now, Wadi Rabah also shows evidence of copper use. This is one of those cultures that enters into the Chalcolithic, which you don't see that at either the Lodian or the Nizanim or the Yarmukian. That is kind of the highlights for Wadi Rabah. There's not quite as good of a map that I found for them, unfortunately, but they are in a number of places. I think they go far north as Syria, and as far south as, Jericho, I think, is as far south as they get. And they're one of the people that are probably using that site in addition to the Lodians. Remember how we talked about, there's not a whole lot of permanent evidence for Jericho at this time. So it's probably being used by a few different people. And that's one thing I want to just remind everyone, that these are probably not permanent cultures. They're probably not even groups using a lot of the same tool assemblages. They may not be all that related to each other. They may only be cousins. They may not be related at all. And it's not a strict linear progression. There's back and forth. There's migrations into and out of the region. Because, again, agriculture is going on. But a lot of these places, it's mostly a pastoral life, more or less. So just keep that in mind. And even once you get to the part where this is the land of Cana, as the Israelis talk about it in the Bible, and even the Egyptians talk about it, the Canaanites are not one people. They are several people spread across tribes and city-states, towns, small regional, loose confederations or tribes. So that's something that's not changing. Just keep that in mind as we talk about this region. And that's part of the reason it's hard to kind of really dial in for me, because I'm always kind of thinking back and forth, like, well, how interconnected are these people politically? Unfortunately, political organization is not something that comes through very well at all in this period. We do see signs of some social stratification as time goes on, especially, but it's not nearly as pronounced as what you're going to see in Mesopotamia for this season. So, just keep that in mind. Now, there is another Chalcolithic or Copper Age society that is in this region this season as well, and we're going to go ahead and move on to them now. And that is the Gusulian culture. Now, these people are to the east of the Dead Sea. They're kind of the eastern neighbors of the Wadi Rabbah, the Lodian culture, the Yarmukian, whatever assemblage of peoples are living in the southern coastal areas of modern-day Palestine, Israel, and Lebanon as well. They are in most of what is now today Jordan. And they are very prolific copper workers. If the pottery of these people is simplistic, the copper work is very intricate and very impressive, honestly. I was surprised at how well they were able to work things, even with just early copper working techniques like cold rolling. They have scepters, almost. I mean, that's what they're called. But who knows what they really were. They wouldn't be useful in a practical sense, but they are very intricate. There are some that have, like, antelope, or possibly just, like, maybe goats. I'm not sure. They look more like antelope than anything. They have very long, kind of backwards horns, whereas they not like rams or goats, where they have the shorter or curled horns. But they'll have, like, a scepter, a base, a metal rod with kind of these very intricately branched out heads, like antelope heads, kind of sticking off in several directions. And they'll be tiered. There might be like a lower tier that's bigger, a secondary tier a little higher up that's a little bit smaller, and then it's capped with even two, with another set of smaller heads. That's one thing that they have. And you can actually see pictures of those online. Although I believe that scepter is actually, technically speaking, bronze. And we talked about this a little bit in the metallurgy episode for this season. There is experimentation with these early copper working societies where they are getting to very low-grade, and I say low-grade, very early bronze work. They are not quite sure on the formula of bronze just yet, but they're experimenting. And that's something you see definitely in the Gusulian culture. And as they experiment with bronze, they also begin to kind of elaborate on their other arts as well. Their pottery becomes some of the more elaborate as time goes on in this region. It's believed that these people migrated from somewhere in the north, probably Anatolia, maybe just northern Mesopotamia, and they moved to the region specifically because they were looking for copper. The drive to find copper is one of the big motivators for migrations, not just in this area, but also in parts of Europe too, and we'll be talking about that in the future as well. Now, these people may have even gone as far south as Egypt. There is some similarities between an Egyptian culture that we'll talk about next season. So they may have even gotten down to, or people related to these people, excuse me, may even get to the Nile Delta next season. Their burial cultures are also different from the peoples we've talked about in the last couple of bits of this part. Those people are continuing the tradition of burying their dead under houses. Oh, and this is one thing I forgot to mention. They're not just burying their dead under their homes anymore. They're doing that, but they're interring their dead actually in these very large pots. Very simplistic, but they're kind of almost caskets in a way. They're kind of like a proto coffin, except not a coffin. It's a big vase or pottery. The Gasulian are not doing that. They are burying their dead in dolmens. They're stacking stones on top of them. And there's even evidence that they would, after a period, exhume their dead and then bury them in the dolmens. So they're practicing a kind of secondary burial. Now, the Gasulian will last until next season, I believe. I think around 3500 BC. And they will even have their own kind of branching culture. This is known as the Beersheba culture. I'm not sure of correct pronunciation. And these people will actually be burying their, or not burying their dead, they'll be burying them in a very similar way, but they will actually be living in almost subterranean housing near kind of caves near the mines and the mountains where they're working and extracting copper from. And they're one of the first people working in the Timna Valley to extract copper. They're not the first people to work in Timna. There are other people getting stones and things like that for decoration purposes, jewelry, ornamentation, things like that. But they're coexisting or competing, maybe, with each other for the resources from this period. And they're also practicing agriculture in addition to pastoralism, hunting, things like that. Now, let me see if there was anything else I wanted to kind of go over. Yeah, I think this is kind of where we can call it for this week. There is some suggestion, and I don't know if it's really elaborated upon, but there are those that believe that these are the people who may have introduced wine to this region. Coming from the north, they may have had access to wine production happening in the Caucasus and the surrounding regions. And one of the reasons people think that is that because they developed these more elaborate drinking vessels, people are thinking that, you know, maybe that they're part of a ritual for imbibing wine, and they're kind of ceremonial. But again, that's kind of speculation. There's no firm evidence that they are drinking wine or growing wine at this point. That's just kind of speculation. So it's possible that they are trading their wares for wine and things like that from the north and other resources. And that's certainly possible, but there's no solid evidence on it. So, yeah, I think this kind of wraps up the Southern Levant for this season. Next week, we'll be moving a little further north. We'll be talking about more places in Syria and southern Anatolia. We also have to deal with Cyprus, because I think Cyprus is still probably culturally more similar to a lot of the places that we'll be talking about next week. But Cyprus will probably be its own episode again. But I'm not 100% on that. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But thank you all for joining me. Apologies if I wasn't quite as clear as I would have liked. And if you have any questions or feedback or constructive criticism, please let me know. You can reach me at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can contact me via direct message on Twitter/X. You can also comment on the YouTube videos. I'll respond as soon as I see comments. And again, if you subscribe to me on YouTube, you are more than welcome. And even if you're not subscribed to me on YouTube, you can come by. I'm streaming most nights there, at least during the week, occasionally on the weekends. And you are welcome to talk and type in the chat and ask questions there. Just, again, be aware, you can't post links. That's something YouTube does not allow, unless you are the streamer themselves. So, if you have any links you want to send me, please do. But you'll have to do that via email or direct message. So, thank you all. I hope you've enjoyed, and I hope I will see you again next week. And yeah, I hope you all have a good rest of your day and week from wherever you're listening to this. And I hope you all take care and stay safe. Thank you all. Peace.